From 7CTOs, my name is Etienne De Bruin, and you're listening to the CTO Podcast. Every week, I spend time with fascinating people that enrich the lives of chief technology officers around the world. From perfecting the basics of building technology organizations to inspiring our minds into shaping our future. As always, the CTO Podcast is brought to you by 7CTOs, helping CTOs become world-class leaders. Let's go. I'm super excited today to welcome Jennifer Swagenberg to the CTO Podcast. She's the head of engineering at Protopia. I got to know her when she was at Toyota in the cybersecurity group, and just an incredible wealth of knowledge, technology enthusiast, software architect, problem solver. So enjoy. Jennifer, welcome to the CTO Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
How do you pronounce your last name?
The C sounds like an S, so it's Swagenberg.
Ah, Swagenberg. Why is that? What language is that?
I believe it's German. The C was originally spelled with a Z, so it was Swagenberg.
Oh, I wonder if it was... Okay, Swagenberg. I wonder if it was an SZ. They like to do that little SZ thing. You know, they have a letter that's sort of a S and a Z.
Yeah.
To those who are listening, I'm furiously trying to show Jennifer what an SZ looks like.
With his hands.
So I told Jennifer I wish we had pressed record on this. Are you comfortable with talking about farm life and acreage expansion and land ownership and being a baroness of Texas?
Of course.
So as a technologist, it must be amazing to be both in the code and on the farm.
It is. For me, it's a love-hate relationship because it's nice to be out in the country to experience nature and vitamin D and all the peace and calm that comes with it. Living where I live, you know, my closest neighbor is probably 2 miles away. The stars are beautiful at night. We hear owls, all types of wildlife. And so it's great. But I give up sacrifices of, I don't have great internet. I don't have a community to meet, to nerd out with that is local. Most of my stuff is all virtual.
Maybe you can start something on your farm?
Maybe.
This has to be the obligatory Elon Musk question. Do you have Starlink?
We do. We actually have two providers for redundancy backup, because it's our day-to-day and our bread and butter. We segment the farm to have basically two different zones. So we do have Starlink.
Did you notice I said Starlink? Okay. Great. Well, I got to know you, I think, about a year ago. It's been incredible. I really love your way of thinking. And do you want to just tell us a little bit about your history, your engineering history?
My entire engineering history or how we met?
Both.
Back when I was a wee engineer, I got my life started in telecom and started out there. Born and raised in Dallas, by the way. So Dallas is headquarters to Match.com. When I was working on my master's, I moved over to Match.com and was there for several years. I worked in different areas of the business. After Match, I went to a startup. I quickly got acquired by another company 2 months later, and then another company after that 3 months later. So I went through two double acquisitions, and that's how I joined our lovely SolarWinds family that people know and love today. After SolarWinds, I joined Toyota, where we met, and was there for a year. And now I have joined an AI startup called Protopia, where I currently reside.
Okay, and what does Protopia do?
Protopia is working on data protection for AI models. So what it does is it allows you to retain ownership of your data so that when it gets sent to a model, you're not exposing your sensitive information.
Got it. Does that include attribution?
The difference with Bertopia is it holistically transforms the input to the model without having to modify the model. So a good example is we did a session with a financial company where they provided a fraudulent check model that banks could upload their check images to an API to determine if a check was fraudulent or not. What that means is they're sending the raw check image outside their trusted zone, outside their bank, over the web to this third party provider, which has the sensitive information like routing numbers, names, signatures in this check image that is now in their zone that gets sent to their model. What we provided was a technology for that financial company that owned the model to create something called, we call it a stained glass transform, which is very lightweight that they then hand to their customers. They feed that check image through this lightweight stained glass transform. It scrambles the image so it no longer looks like a check to you or me, but it's still in a state that there's still enough information retained that the fraudulent check model can still predict if it's fraudulent check with now not looking at a check image.
In its simplest form, it's not necessarily an image obfuscation technology. You're just using that as an example of how you can use the stained glass model as a way to encode something, compress it so that it can be uncompressed.
Yeah, it's a one-way stochastic transformation, so it can't be reversed. Another example that is really relevant these days are LLMs. So for example, the plain text that you send to an LLM, let's say Llama 2, they can transform it. So then if you were to try to find the best representation of that, that it now looks like garbly gook, unreadable text that makes no sense to anybody that sees it, but there's still enough information retained that the model Llama 2 or whoever can still predict, you know, respond to the expected question.
The types of technologies we're going to have being built in now and in the future is fascinating. I wanted to shift a little bit to what fascinates you.
Technology. How fortunate are we in a field that we get immediate satisfaction of building something and getting that feedback loop? I think it's very powerful. It's different than other different types of engineering where, yeah, people build houses, they build all this stuff. But for me, it's so passionate and so rewarding to be part of technology and be able to have impact by something that I'm physically able to do or you know, mentally, that it every day I'm thankful that I chose this profession.
Yeah, I map it a little bit to the world has this insatiable desire for innovation or solutions that technology has to offer. And it has this perpetual desire that sucks, that has the opportunity to suck more and more people, developers, engineers, into that ecosystem that then can provide a level of prosperity to people that may have never considered a role or a career in technology. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I was working with another company that actually had somebody that went to law school, got their law degree, was an attorney and hated it and has found he has a passion for engineering and turned out to be a great engineer.
Are there specific aspects to technology? So you joined the AI company. Previously, you were at Toyota, Match.com. Is there a sense about you as to what about technology or what types of technologies fascinate you? Or is it just the ability to create and it doesn't matter so much where we're headed or what we're doing?
For me, it's always been about the challenge. So not specific to technology or necessarily a focus area like UI or databases or anything like that, which I think has shown for me and my adaptability as I've gone across domains and use cases and technologies, it's really about the challenge and being able to tackle the problem. So at Match, I had a few different roles that were around data and building their ETL and business intelligence to then working on writing applications and working on their real-time search engine for all the searches that would go through Match when you wanted to find somebody that was 6 foot tall with blonde hair and blue eyes, to working on their operations and understanding how they scale out their servers and their workloads for their on-prem centers, to then doing security at Toyota and learning how they protect the cars, to all that aspects, to now being a part of an AI company. The thing that I find correlations across the challenges, I think, and one of the things that I enjoy including being remote, is it's surprising how there's overlap in so much of the concepts. And that applies to farming as well. The things that they're doing in technology and agriculture is just mind-blowing, to the science of how people are doing A/B testing to find out if they feed, you know, cattle this and rotate this, that they get the most gain. Like, engineering for me touches all aspects of my life, including technology, including agriculture, including living out on the farm.
That's not something I thought of. I mean, yes, my father-in-law is a no-till farmer. This whole paradigm shift from highly optimized process to extract as much nutrition from the soil and just basically pillage whatever nutrition is in the soil, plant your crop, harvest your crop, and then dump as much fertilizer as you can back into the soil. It's almost like they're, you know, farmers over the decades have been using soil just as this substance that can, you can push things into and sort of keeps things up. And then you go to no-till farming, which I think is about 2 or 3 decades old and is widely practiced in countries like Argentina and now in the US, where you treat the soil as this beautiful microorganism or a cosmos, microcosmos, where you have life, and you treat the soil with incredible sort of care and reverence. That kind of scientific shift. Now, what that means is you can't destroy weeds like you used to, because obviously, as you're not tilling the soil,
you're not destroying the roots of the weeds.
Yes. And so now you have this huge advancement in the science of herbicides that can now kill weeds without killing the soya plants. Just phenomenal to see the advancement in science in that domain.
Yeah, we have parts of our farm that are no-till specifically because we have highly erodible land. And the no-till is a requirement to be in different farm programs if you want some of that assistance.
Oh, interesting. So sort of a regulatory governmental oversight?
Yeah. Well, if you want to be in some of these farm programs where I think they provide seeds or give you subsidies and things like that, then, you know, there are different requirements that you would have to do depending on your land. And for us, you know, it could be potentially the no-till because of the highly erodible nature of it.
Are you also doing seed farming? You do cattle?
We do cattle. If we plant, it's usually for hay crops for the cattle.
Mm. How would you say you're using your engineering prowess on the farm?
You know, one of the things that actually fascinated me that I learned is this last batch of cattle that we bought, they were actually DNA typed. And they were DNA typed to evaluate their producing as like, are they gonna have a long career in producing calves? Are they gonna be calm by nature? Are they gonna have all these specific qualities that would help give them a long productive life cycle as we were a cow-calf operation? And so it's been really interesting to see that aspect of the technology. For us, one of the things that we learned is, just like I have 7 CTOs and the support that you guys provide, where I live, there is an equivalent for farmers that's in Oklahoma called the Noble Foundation. The Noble Foundation provides a lot of free resources and education for people within a certain radius about farming. And a lot of that came down to, I didn't grow up as a farmer, So I thought, oh, the bigger the cow, the better, right? More meat, more cost effective, because now I have one cow and I only have one mouth to feed versus two cows. But in reality, the science behind it and the aspects that the Noble Foundation taught me is they look at the data as a whole holistic metric of, okay, if you get medium cows, well, then you can have more cows and they overall eat less and it's cheaper to send them to market because now they fit inside, you know, the standard categories of however they butcher them up. You know, I'm sorry if you guys, you know, don't want to go down this subject, but
we'll just bleep that part out. Butcher.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of like, you know, that it's all about the package, right? So if the cows are the same size, it's cheaper for me to have them in how they fit, I guess, maybe in the deli or something like that versus having to do more work and things. So the end of the day, the medium cow is the most profitable because of all these data points and metrics and how you care for them.
That is very interesting. All the added costs, the mini costs. I mean, I think one could also pull that into one's engineering team, the types of engineers you have working on what types of problems. And it's not always the smartest, most senior engineer is going to give you what you thought you wanted.
Well, I thought about this correlation a little bit because to me, it's also about like effort, right? So you do these things where you rotate the cows quite often because then they don't eat the grass down to the soil so that the grass can regrow and all the stuff. But you do all these little things and these little things end up having the largest impact to your land, your cost, and all of these things. And so I've actually been debating about this or my thought process was, it's really about how much time and effort do you invest, right? If I have an engineering project, am I going to go for the big win or the prize in the sky that's going to be huge effort and all these things? But in reality, I don't need that big thing, the smaller medium, which would be smaller effort, quicker to deliver, you know, give me business value now. Where do I spend, how much time and resources do I spend to solve a problem that I need to do today?
Are you ready to elevate your team's performance and your own career as CTO? Introducing the 7CTOs Growth Program. With 7CTOs, you'll join a supportive community of tech leaders dedicated to helping you reach new heights. Our group coaching program, led by experienced CTOs, focuses on the proven CTO levels framework. Assess your team, processes, and technology challenges with our easy-to-complete assessments, and then dive deep into monthly coaching calls where you'll get unstuck and gain insights on specific topics. Craft actionable plans tailored to your needs, guided by expert advice and playbooks designed to drive results. Plus, gain access to our exclusive CTO community for ongoing support and collaboration. Sign up now and start your group coaching adventure for only $300 per month or $3,000 per year. Your membership includes priority access to all 7CTO's events and activities. Don't miss out on the opportunity to join a global community of experienced CTOs, attend virtual events, and participate in confidential group coaching sessions. Visit 7ctos.com/growth and level up your leadership skills today. In your day-to-day, are you operating as more of a manager of people, or are you contributing code, or what is your role, for instance, at Protopia?
So my role is VP of engineering. So in the startup nature, it's a plethora of responsibilities as we get the people, time, and bandwidth to do things. It is a manager of people. There is some individual contributions I still do as long as there's time as well as wherever the business need is needed.
How many people on your team then? And do they have a CTO? Like, just give us an idea of the topology.
Yeah. So the current topology is we have a CEO, we have a SVP for sales, we have a VP for go-to-market, and then we have a team of research engineers that are our machine learning engineers that help produce our product and our correlations. Then we have our ML engineers and our solution engineers that help facilitate maybe the bridge between the researchers and software engineers. And our solution engineer deals with, you know, our customers and helping implement things in their environment. We currently don't have a CTO.
And then the number of engineers that you have?
The overall engineering team currently, not including open headcount, I believe is 10.
Do you have a favorite tool that you want all your people to use? Technology tool?
There are so many tools, and we're in an interesting space where we have very talented machine learning scientists. We have very talented software engineers and solution engineers. And what we do, or what has been core to us, is trying to unify the developer experience or our environments, so that while we're trying to debug in one area, or, you know, we're trying to collaborate, the experience is the same between us. Majority of us, if not all of us, have adopted actually VS Code. And we have found that VS Code is so powerful because of all the plugins that it's easy to see something on somebody else's screen. It's like, oh, I really like how you had that set up. How do we unify and how do we share that? So one of the things that I've been passionate about, or that I really like lately, is the Visual Studio or the VS Code profiles, so that as a team, if we're the majority of us are doing Python, I can now share my settings and my tools of how I have everything configured as far as my linters, as far as my plugins and everything with other developers to have that unified environment.
I've always had sort of a question about that approach where a developer may want some things from your profile, but not everything.
Yeah. What I appreciate about VS Code is when I take somebody else's profile, I still have the ability to uncheck anything that I don't want. So I don't have to bring it in everything, but at least I have visibility now to see everything that they had.
Got it. And as far as working with your engineering team goes, do you mandate the use of something like Copilot or ChatGPT for the coding, or do you let everybody do what they want to do?
Because we're a data privacy company and we're about data security for ML, we're very cautious and do a lot of due diligence internally in what we will and will not do. So we haven't officially adopted any of those tools because of those reasons.
Great. Any book you've read recently that you want to talk about?
There are a lot of books that I read, but the recently thing is what got me. I do need to do more recent reading, and actually have gotten a lot of recommendations in the last month. If I thought about books that I thought had an impact for me, I chose The Clean Code. I saw it as on one of the lists, actually, of the 7CTO book list. But that book itself had a huge impact on me, because it gave me a way to explain really easy things that I thought people would relate to or felt like would be common sense. It's one of those things that once you read it, you're like, oh yeah, the light bulb's on. Like, of course that's what we should do. But until then, it was like you could see the picture through the fog, but not actually, you know, be able to tell what the picture was about.
Can you just tell, for those who don't know, what the book is about?
Yeah, the book is about, again, since I'm passionate about developer experience, but it's about best practices or ideas of writing clean code and following the standard conventions to make sure that you're doing, I'm going to call it best practices, for maintainability and readability of code that you write.
Yeah, clean code.
Yeah. I mean, it's as simple as, in the beginning, as an engineer, one of the concepts in the book is about removing unused code. It's easy to get into the habit where you maybe comment out stuff, but you don't want to remove it because maybe there's some history there or it makes sense to keep it around. But the reality of it is it just clutters the code and everybody will be afraid to delete it, right? Because, well, if nobody removed it, that must be there for a reason. Or if there's comments that go along with it about maybe why it was commented out or something like that, that just rots. And people don't keep it up to date. So why not go ahead and remove it? That's why we have Git history. That's why we have these things, that it's not lost forever. So why not go ahead and do the right thing and just remove the dead code or this commented out code that's not being used?
Yeah, it's funny for me how still in the 2020s, we still have this commenting code situation. I think sometimes it's because Git revisions or going back or reverting code feels more scary than just uncommenting code.
Yeah, especially with all the features nowadays that make it easy to compare or even search where something was last in Git. Removing the code and the reasons behind it makes perfect sense.
Mm. I asked you what problem exists in the world today that you feel most passionate about, and I really loved what you said about making the right thing easy and all things that that entails. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. As an engineer, I already have so many challenges I have to tackle, right? Nowadays, it's not just one thing. I don't just write Java code. I don't just build an API. The thought process is most engineers are probably doing multiple things, including now having to worry about security, now having to worry about CI/CD, now doing UI and all these things. And when I have so much on my plate, I want to remove some of the burden of the challenges that come along with being able to be a subject matter expert in all the things, or also fall into the same tracks. So an example of this is, as we bring in new engineers, if I already have a practice of this repo has linting on it, we provide pre-commit hooks, we have CI/CD, then it's going to be very obvious that, okay, our coding standards are, we expect doc strings, that we expect unit testing and all these, and it makes my life as a code reviewer much easier, but it also helps influence the culture of, these are our standards and there's no question on what the expectation is. Making that visibility or the expectation easy, building in the security into the developer lifecycle to make my job easy, or I'm going to think about it, but that's such a large scope, then please help me what I don't know and make that easy for me. But the problems and challenges I've seen lately as well is, there have been a couple instances where we had, let's say, unexpected bugs, and what could we learn from that, and what did we miss? Not for a blame scenario, but let's learn from that and protect us from doing it again, or the next guy that's going to come in that's probably going to make the same mistake.
The team then works together to sort of codify those best practices or the dev culture that you want to have.
Yes.
So for instance, someone wants to commit code that doesn't have any unit tests associated with it, somehow have a pre-commit hook that just asks you about that, or in the CI/CD, I suppose.
Yeah, so you can't necessarily enforce a pre-commit on an end user, but they'll find that they'll get faster feedback and maybe prefer to use it. Majority of us do use them. But then in our CI/CD, we have rules that say, we expect 70% code coverage. So if you push tests that don't have unit tests or code coverage, well, then we won't be able to merge your PR, for example.
In your role as VP of engineering reporting to the CEO?
Yes.
Is there a reason do they just not want to have a CTO, or is that, I guess, I don't want to get into company politics, but
I'm sure there will be a time we'll add a CTO, but we're so small in nature, it just didn't make sense to do that at this time.
Yeah. Very cool. This has been great. I really appreciate talking to someone with such hands-on experience in both coding and farming. That's the show. Check out ctopod.com. Stay connected. We love hearing from CTOs. We love hearing from CEOs. Anybody who needs to get their CTO plugged in, check out 7ctos.com. There are membership levels for everybody, so it's never too late to expand your network, nurture your relationships, and please, let's see each other soon, like next week. Cheers.